This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm Katie Rich. I am here for today's interview episode with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And with David Canfield.
Hello.
Today, we have two interviews. Rebecca, first, we hear your conversation with Jacqueline West and Julie O'Keefe, the costume designers of Killers of the Flower Moon. And then, David, we'll hear your conversation with Cynthia Erivo about her film Drift. So, Rebecca, you got the chance to talk to two of the costume designers, visionaries, incredible creatives behind Killers of the Flower Moon, which is just as massive a film as I think you would expect from Martin Scorsese at this phase in his career. And the costumes in particular required so much of these two designers and capture so much of this story. I am really curious to hear what you talked to Jacqueline West and Julie O'Keefe about.
Yeah, I'm sure you had the same experience as I did when you saw this, Katie, is the costumes are so incredible, especially the detail that went into the Osage people's wardrobe, because it seemed very clear to me they were trying to get it very accurate. So I was really interested to hear about that. You know, Jacqueline West is a very well-known costume designer, four Oscar nominations, somehow no wins, but, you know, she did Dune, Revenant, Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And so she actually brought on Julie O'Keefe, who served as the Osage wardrobe consultant and is a part of that community and was able to really speak to, you know, the history and the design and bring in artisans to create these authentic pieces.
Yeah, when you read the book by David Gran, there's all these descriptions of these Osage people who are kind of have their traditional dressing that they've worn for centuries, but then got very, very wealthy and would adopt all these kind of nouveau riche fur coats and things like that appropriate to the 20s. And that combination was captivated so many newspaper writers at the time, like couldn't believe that you could combine these two things. And I think the movie captures that contrast so visually, but also makes it clear that like why, how these kind of unlikely outfits that we would think of now belong to these people in this specific place and time. It all feels so incredibly detailed, not just about the Osage culture, but this moment in the Osage culture.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to Jacqueline about this, but I guess Brad Pitt once called her a method costumer because she does such an incredible amount of research and she really believes that the clothes inform the performance, you know, and she talks about how wearing those more high-waisted pants, even on the men in this film or for Brad Pitt and Benjamin Button, changed the way people walk. The way putting on these blankets changes the way that people carry themselves. And it's true. I think you can really see the way it colors performance.
Well, I feel like there's so much to get into. I cannot wait to hear all about it. Let's hear your conversation with costume designers Jacqueline West and Julie O'Keefe.
I'm so excited to welcome Jacqueline West and Julie O'Keefe to the podcast. They're the duo behind the incredible costumes of Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which begins rolling out in theaters this weekend. I saw the film way back at the Cannes Film Festival in May and was struck by how big of a job it must have been to create the costumes for this incredible movie. So I'm so happy to have you both here.
We're happy to be here.
Yes.
Thanks for joining me. Jacqueline, you have a lot of experience with really big, ambitious films, period films. I feel like you've done a lot of big work, but I actually read that on a panel earlier this year, you said Killers of the Flower Moon was the most incredible experience of your film career. Can you tell me why this film holds that place for you?
My husband's part Native American, and since I was a small child, my favorite people in all movies were the Native Americans. There was something romantic about it to me. Then I was a hippie girl, and we all wanted to dress. We all wore fringe and tried to, you know, emulate that romantic look of the plains. But my mother was a fashion designer, so I segued after having a clothing company into doing film. And I always wanted to work on a film about Native Americans, and fortunately was hired early on in my career by Terrence Malick. So then that led to The Revenant. And all of those experiences, each film I'm on is my favorite film at the time, because film is like time travel. You get to immerse yourself into another culture and another time. And we all live in the present, and this is a rare experience of getting to really almost feel like you're living in another time and creating it, and then being able to crawl in. My favorite movies I've ever seen are movies I wanted to crawl into and be in. And the whole time I was making this, I wanted to be in it and part of it. Even though it's a tragic story, the characters are compelling, and you just want to be part of it. But for me, it was a high point in my career. I've worked with the most, I think, brilliant directors there are. But to get to work finally with Martin Scorsese was a high point. My husband said, okay, now you can quit. You work with Marty, you can quit now. But yeah, this was a magical experience for me. And the friends that I made, and having my dream crew that I take from big movie to big movie along with me. They're not always all available, mm-hmm. but they were all available. Having Julie by my side, who was, you know, she was like some kind of a barometer of where we were at, what we were doing. And I really loved the epic quality of this movie. I got to dress so many different levels. I got to do cowboys. I got to do Native Americans. I got to do businessmen. I got to do flappers. I got to do, you know, women. And this is such a crossover time in American history. It's one of my favorites, where the horse and the car collide mm-hmm. on the same streets. So, yeah, it was a high point.
And tell me about the two of you teaming up, Julie, how you were brought on this project, and sort of your initial impressions about what might be the biggest challenges.
Well, I was brought on, I had never been in this industry before. So my chief actually called me. I was working on a contract actually for First Americans Museum, and my background's in product development. And I'd had a shop that produced museum quality Native regalia. And it was in Pawhuska, but I was living in DC and would bring items from New York and different places and materials that my people couldn't get down in Oklahoma. And so I had that shop for probably about 10 years, and it was called the Cedar Chest. And so he called one day and he said, Julie, you know, this movie's coming. We're really going to have the right person, you know, come in and really help. And you're one of the best candidates I can think of for going into a situation that you don't know anything about, basically going in and helping. And I said, and I almost said no. I was like, you know, Chief, I have this contract, and it's for a year and whatever, but it was during COVID. And so it, you know, COVID really allowed for a lot of projects and things, you know, if you work from home, and I did already, to come to you. And so he said, you know, oh, please. So I turned my resume in before COVID. COVID comes and shuts everything down, comes back up again, and Jackie's team comes in. And so they take my resume and they go ahead and give me a call. And so I come in and I am blown away by the amount of research, and I mean thousands of photographs, and really broken out into how people are men and women and traditional and modern traditional. And she really broken these out into these storyboards, but I mean floor to ceiling. And so it was some of the best wallpaper I ever saw, because that's what it looked like when you walked in there. But anyway, so I came to it that way. And when I started, And I could really understand walking in there clearly how she was thinking and it had was mapping it out. And my community had met with Martin Scorsese and had invited him to dinner and a couple of dinners. And it was very serious discussion for the citizens of the Osage Nation, because this is a topic that's extremely hard for us to talk about, even in our families. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of generational trauma that comes with it. So it was really a project that was really felt like that I was supposed to be a part of. And the reason being that I was there to help represent my people. And there's really no greater gift than that for me. You know, it's when you're helping your family and you're helping your community. And that's really how that project, and it turned into a community project.
Hmm. And you're referencing some of, I assume, the very in-depth research that went into preparing for this project. But Jacqueline, I'm curious, through that process, what did you discover that sort of surprised you that maybe you hadn't expected to be part of your decision-making?
Well, as I said, I'd done other Plains Native peoples before in other movies, but I had never really researched the Osage Nation before. And the most startling thing was right at the beginning, an image my husband found who was helping me. It was during COVID, and we were at our house in Deadwood, South Dakota. And we went to the library in Rapid City. And also there's an incredible library in Deadwood. And so we really started diving in together, and he was helping me because we were kind of stuck there, you know. There was no reason to go back to Los Angeles with all the hospitals filled. So we started in, and the first thing he showed me that he found that I'd never seen and that is totally unique to the Osage is the wedding coat. And I got so excited when I saw it. It was really, you know, Regency meets Native America. And I said, oh, God, if only. I said, I'll never make that. That'll never fly. It looked next to all the other, you know, Plains research that I had done in so many movies. It looked so unique and so over the top almost. You know, it was like putting a Marie Antoinette into a horse opera. You know, it's like just.
With ribbon work. Wouldn't she be fabulous?
Yeah. So I couldn't believe it. But in the end, I started reading about it and its history and how it evolved to become part of Osage regalia. And I thought, okay, I'm going to show Marty. And I did. And he just loved it. And that whole scene, we knew that there would be a wedding scene in the movie then and there. Mm-hmm. So that was probably the most important thing. I think maybe that and the otter hats.
Yes, for sure.
We're so unique. Mm-hmm. As are the ribbon work. The calico shirts are pretty much through the plains because of the trading posts. Mm-hmm. But the ribbon work, the finger weaving, and the wedding coats, mm-hmm. the otter hats, those are really unique to the Osage because there have been cookie cutter representations all through the years in Hollywood. And that would have been the biggest disservice to this magnificent artistic peoples.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine that authenticity must have been, you know, of the highest priority for both of you and Marty. But Julie, for you, what did you want to sort of protect the most or make sure was correctly represented of the Osage people?
My home on the reservation so I could go back home and face everybody. Actually, the truth is a lot of our history is told within the materials of our clothing. Mm. You know, that silhouette and those materials have not changed for over 150 years. And so you start doing a timeline of, you know, when they would have come from Missouri, which those materials were already in our clothing. And we moved in 1860 from Missouri to Oklahoma. They brought that with them. We had to leave so much behind, but we brought that with us. And so as you can kind of see how that trickles down into the timeline into 1920. And the broadcloth is something that was traded, you know, as passage across our lands. That was, gifts. I mean, Lewis and Clark actually had that within. I tried to reproduce it at one time through my shop, and I had to buy so much of it. I was afraid of moths. But the truth was that as you start looking and understanding why French ribbon, and, you know, we have fantastic artisans that, you know, some of the best art doesn't come from large studios. It comes from kitchen tables. Mm. And I'm a native art consultant in what I call my real life, even though I think this is my real life now. But anyway, but they basically will cut these families that like their family patterns, and they will cut and fold. It's not an applique type of if they're cut, they cut and fold. And same with the finger weaving. It's quintessential Osage. And I just went to a discussion at First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City just 2 weeks ago. And I'm walking through this exhibit, and I see this photograph where they're showing an Osage woman. And typically they tie that on the back of their chairs, but this woman has tied it to the actual handle of a window. And this is probably from the 1900s. And she's weaving this belt either for her daughter or her granddaughter, but she's weaving you can see it's a belt. And so, you know, the artisans of that time, we only have five left that can even do that. And we engaged those people to come in and help us do this through our cultural center. We reached out into the community. We reached out to, you know, the people that I knew to be some of the oldest ribbon work maker families, because that comes down in the generations. Mm-hmm. And so the authenticity part of that you're drawing out are these pieces. And, you know, you kind of get into this question of costume or clothing, and it's like, okay, it's costume for a film. But I would tell you that every single piece is of authentic, original material. So there was no skimping on the 27 yards of ribbon that went into Lily's blanket that she has on underneath her wedding coat in one of the scenes. And a very well-known family is the Lookout family, and Marie Lookout made that particular blanket. But it's you just get into the intricacies of that. And that's one thing that I'm very proud of, because this really was a community project, and everyone did it with just their full hearts, wanting to help get this right.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
Was there a scene where, when it was finally filming, all your work came to fruition and you were able to witness it, that was the most powerful moment for you to be there on set, for both of you to be there on set and sort of witness?
One really important scene for me, I think, was the delegation leaving from Fairfax to Washington, D.C., because the tragedy is already quite far along. Mm-hmm. And it's like enough of this attack, this horrible, you know, genocide on our people. And that they put on those blankets, it was like armor, okay, heading. It was almost like a war party, mm-hmm, heading for Washington, D.C. You fix this or else. Mm-hmm. And there was something about that scene that so moved me. Mm-hmm. The overhead shots that Rodrigo did, mm-hmm, that they're all there and you see the sadness on their faces. And because this was so, we used so many people from the Osage Nation in that scene, mm-hmm, and you felt, I get chills when I think about it, you felt how they felt at that point in time, mm-hmm, what a journey this was going to be. It wasn't a political delegation. This was really like a war party going to Washington, D.C., giving the facts to the president and making this like an important agenda for the United States government.
Julie, do you have a scene that sort of sticks with you?
And I love the wedding scene, of course. Yeah. That a lot of work went into that.
Yes, it did.
There was something about the emotionality, though, of that train station scene.
Well,
them all lined up.
Right. And the interesting part is if you go back in that picture of the original photo of that, there are descendants of some of those people that are actually in that delegation.
Wow.
So imagine when you're thinking about your great-great-grandfather basically being a part of that delegation, and then you're in a movie portraying that. And we had several people all through the movie. And, you know, I would tell you more than a scene, because every one of the scenes were important to me when it involved Osages or Lily or the sisters or whatever mm-hmm. was going on. You know, it's always that for me, it's always, I'm goal-oriented. So it's always the task at the time, we're getting it right. You know, I have everything that I need, which Jackie was having produced by this fabulous team that she has, to be able to come in. You know, I know that I've got the right families plugged in to get this, to help us do this, and achieving each one of those scenes. And the interesting part to me is, you know, Jacqueline had gone to Pendleton and had them reproduce the blankets at that time. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of questions about, you know, blankets and, you know, people really trying to explain it. But what blankets and shawls do in that movie is basically tell you about an event that's happening right then. Because different ways and folding, you know, I kind of joke around, but I'm very serious. But the fact is, it's like Osage origami, because you are constantly folding and changing. This person has had a tragedy or a death. We're going to put a black shawl on this person, and she's going to be combing her mother's hair. And we need to fold that up in a way where she's using this as you know, a statement that she's making of mourning because her mother's passing. And she's sitting there, but we have to work with that so that she can live with it in everyday life, just as simple as using a comb. And it has all this fringe on it, beautiful fringe. So working with Lily, but also so that I understood her tasks of what she was doing, and then we could work with that. And then going in that delegation, every single one of those Osage, if you look in that, are wearing a blanket when they get to. They have their finery on. They have their fur coats. They have their French shoes. They have all of that. But they, almost every one of them has a blanket. And, you know, it's a power suit in a way where you're walking in and telling somebody, we're showing up here as a group. We're intimidating. I mean, we were a tribe. You know, we were used to going out and intimidating when we had to. And to also come in, because you are asking for help. But it's one of those, it's we're out of respect, we're wearing this. But it's also a situation when we have come to talk business with you, and you are going to talk business with us. And so you're making a statement. And I would say the other thing, like Chief Bonnycastle. So you have Chief Bonnycastle, who has a certain way that he's wearing his blanket, which is a long style. Mm. You have people that are leaders and what we call roadmen, but roadmen are really holy men. And so we're putting those blankets around their waist. And a lot of times, if you're in anything that's a religious ceremony, a lot of times the men will put those around their waist. And they still do that to this day. So, you know, and for the women with shawls or wearing blankets just to go down to the bank or to conduct business at the mercantile or wherever they're going, you know, they're going to be wearing those certain ways so that people, you know, kind of know that you're out for doing business and hi, how are you? But you can really tell and set a scene if you watch kind of the different ways, you know, something else is going on.
So fascinating. You know, in a more general sense, I'm curious what the two of you learned from each other working together on this.
That we really like it. We like each other.
Yes. I had never worked with a consultant that was with me all the time. And there was, at first, I thought, oh, can I work that way? You know, I'm only used to showing things to a director. I've never had, you know, a collaborator with me all the time, looking at what we were doing and getting it right. But there was something really, to me, very comforting But that's not even the right word. It was more, we had more of a intellectual rapport about this, that I had someone to talk to and to kind of be a barometer how the rest of the elders, Osage elders, were seeing us and looking at us and at the degree of their approval. And it was really, really interesting because my main focus was to get this right, because it's such a heartfelt story for these people. And it's one that I wanted to make sure I got right for all of the people that will see it in the world, because this is a story no one knew about until the David Graham book, unless you lived in Pawhuska, maybe.
Right.
It's even a Native American nation you don't even study in school because of what happened. Mm-hmm. And it's been buried. And it was really important for me. I think it could change how people think about Native Americans and what has happened to them historically in America. This movie could change the whole way of thinking about things.
And I think even without getting too political, but Killers of the Flower Moon went on the list of books in Oklahoma to not read in schools. And there was a children's version that came out. And I sat on the Osage Foundation, so we bought like 1,000 copies and donated it to all the schools in Osage County.
Fabulous.
And Tulsa, where I live.
I'm from Berkeley. Get political.
So anyway, but you know, even to this day, so we knew these stories in our families, but it was very hard for our stories, you know, because there is a lot of generational trauma with it. And people were frightened to talk about it, so they just didn't talk about it. They either moved away or you stopped talking. I mean, as a shareholder, the first thing that your family tells you if you inherit head rights is, you know, Julie, don't talk about this. Never talk, never. I mean, they would be upset with me for talking to you about it right now, but it's really one of those where it was a hush-hush kind of thing because no one wanted you to be the next target. And this went on really into the 60s. It finally, in 1972, there was a law firm that came in and finally wrote the laws within Osage law, but really within federal law, where it was that the shares and the shareholders, when you pass away, has to go to someone of Osage descent. And so that stopped a lot of the killing. But so it's been a very long haul for us. And, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people when this story comes out, I know that there are a lot of people who are descendants of the other side, I'll call them, I'll say that, they're not really wanting it to be told because it's just horrible human behavior. And nobody really wants to grapple with that these days. You know, it seems that people come and go with that, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be incredible when this reaches, you know, such a wide audience, both when it comes on theaters and streaming, which it's just about to do by the time this interview comes up. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to wrap up with Jacqueline. I read this quote that I guess is Brad Pitt described you on The Curious Case of Benjamin Button as a method costumer. And I'm curious what you think about holding that title and how that describes how you work.
Well, it was one of the nicest things ever said about me, I have to say. It came out in a fitting, one of my first fittings I ever did with Brad. He had 108 changes in Benjamin Button. Right? So I was a fashion designer, but I was an art historian. And when I decided to do this, Philip Kaufman brought me into the business, The Right Stuff, Unbearable Lightness of Being. And he said, you can do this, you know, you have a big clothing company. If you can make that many clothes and, you know, departments in Barney's and everything, you can do this. He said, because you're an art historian. So I decided, how am I going to do this? And I thought, well, who was the great, and I read the biography of Edith Head. And she said, the first thing you do on a movie is read the script 7 times before you do anything. So you know every character inside out. Then when I was at Berkeley, I had the joy of meeting Anna Eastnin because I'd read all her diaries, and she was sitting in a coffee house that I frequented in Berkeley, and she invited me to sit with her because she saw I was reading her diary in the coffee house. 1931 to 33. And in that diary, she said that how you discover a person's inner riches are in the details. She said, even a hanky in a purse will reveal, when it comes out, will reveal something about that character, that it's all in the details. And so between dressing somebody from the inside out, like Edith Head suggested, I always focused on the details. What would be the thing, one thing I could give each character as a talisman of who they are? Because I've always felt, and I told this to Brad, the wardrobe fitting is the first time an actor is in character. That's the bridge from the actor to the character, is when they put the clothes on. Mm. And I saw it with Jeffrey Rush and Quills. He put the Marquis de Sade satin suit on and was walking around the grounds in Luton Hoo, which we shot as Charenton. He's very languid and loose, Jeffrey, and he became a marquis in that suit with those shoes. And it changes. If you've done your job right, it will change how you walk. And so when Brad said, do I really have to wear my pants up this high? And I said, yes, it's the period. You'll walk differently. And he was at American Costume in Los Angeles, and he walked down the aisles, and he came back, and he walked differently. He said, you're right. He said, you're really methody. And Brad, people don't realize that about Brad, because he's so good looking, that he's really a method actor. And that's when he came up with that description. He said, you really have made me feel like Benjamin on the inside.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Okay, David, now we'll hear your conversation with Cynthia Erivo. Her film Drift premiered at Sundance earlier this year and is one of the rare films that actors can actually talk about these days, which is thrilling. How was your conversation with Cynthia?
Yeah, so Drift was produced outside of the U.S. It is not a SAG-covered project, and SAG has encouraged those films, the actors in those films, to promote their films. So another example is Helen Mirren and Golda, who's currently on the campaign trail. And Erivo plays a West African refugee who has arrived in Greece, and it's in many ways a silent performance. You know, we're getting to know this character in this, to her, very foreign land. She has this incredible trauma that she is dealing with, escaping from, and the film really hinges on her performance and just watching her processing what's happened to her and trying to imagine a way forward. And I think for me, when I first saw it, I was just incredibly moved by her performance. And it's the kind of movie that is not an easy watch. It's not going to find the biggest audience, but I think it really does move those who are able to find it.
I love that, you know, Cynthia Erivo is this very famous Broadway performer. She's got this very famous voice. She's got Wicked coming around the pike. So thinking of her doing a silent performance and kind of stretching her abilities and showing how much she can do, maybe ahead of that, once again, career-redefining movie Wicked, is a really interesting move on her part.
It's also fascinating because, you know, there are a number of projects that we couldn't talk about because of the strike, because she is still an actor on strike. And in my research for this, she's done quite literally exclusively studio movies until this one. And this is a movie she really helped get off the ground as a producer. It's a story she really connected with. And it's a real change of pace for her, both working behind the scenes for the first time in such a capacity and getting this movie off the ground. And then also a movie like this requires, demands a different kind of acting, a different level of acting. And it's really a mode in which I'd never seen her before, where, as you mentioned, on the Color Purple stage, she is so big and boisterous. Or in movies like Widows, where we've come to know her on the screen. This is a very new side of her and one that I think is really exciting and hints at a really varied screen career.
Well, I want to hear what she has to say about it. Let's hear your conversation with Cynthia Erivo.
Cynthia, you're here to speak about the film Drift, which I first saw in Sundance, out of Sundance, and I found it really moving. I have to say, though, I rewatched it just in prep for this week, and it hit me a little bit differently, just given everything going on in the world right now. And what this film, I think, really beautifully captures about the experience of a refugee who's escaping a really traumatic experience. I'm curious how you're thinking about the movie right now.
Yeah, I it's so funny because when you do these things, you don't know how relevant they'll be or how much of an effect they'll make. I just knew that when I was making it, I read it and that was beautiful. And I desperately wanted to give voice to those people who wouldn't necessarily even be noticed. And with everything that's happening today and right now, I don't know, there's just something that is really poignant. And I feel like it's really important for people to take a look at those who you might not realize are going through things that we could never even imagine. And the fact that they're still like standing or even making an effort to move forward every day is a frigging miracle.
I have a lot of questions about your performance in this movie, but given that current resonance, I'm just curious in the research, in the portrayal of this character, what you learned about that experience that was really important to you to bring forward in the character.
The thing I really felt was important was to make sure that we didn't lose her humanity. We didn't lose the will that she had to live, and we didn't lose her dignity. And you know, my mother was an immigrant, and she came over from Nigeria, and she was also a part of the Biafran War. So she was also dealing with all of those things. The thing that we don't get to see when they're portrayed, when these people are portrayed on film or TV often, is dignity. Yes, we see their circumstance, we see what they're going through, we see how much they need, but we lose the fact that they still are people who have dignity, who want to present themselves in a certain way. I think the wonderful thing about Jacqueline is that she still wants to present. She still wants to be as together as she possibly can, with whatever little that she has. And I just thought that there was such a human thing that we all want. We all want to be seen in a certain way. And she didn't want pity. She's so scared to open up, mainly because she wants to be treated as an equal when up against other people. And I really wanted that for her. I really wanted her dignity to shine through.
Yeah, I think it really does. And I think that it showcases the power of the movie in a context like this, where, you know, we look at, say, what's going on in Israel, and there are just these huge, overarching, extraordinary questions of conflict and pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that a character study like this does really just introduce you to the individual human experience in a way right. that can be harder for us, wherever we are, to grasp.
Yeah. I think it's just this, and that's it really. It's that one singular person, you know, as opposed to grouping everyone in as a whole. Mm-hmm. Each person has their own particular experience, and one might be different to the other. But in pulling out one person, you get to understand that each person you look at isn't just experiencing the same thing. They are all going through their own separate experiences and pain and loss or life. And I think being able to focus in on one person allows us to see the whole a little bit clearer.
Well, let's go back to the genesis of this project a little bit. I saw you were a producer on this. I believe it's, you know, your first, you know, full producing credit. Mm-hmm. So what about this project felt like the movie to make that kind of leap with particularly?
It just was really special. I read it in many iterations and it changed a lot before we got it to screen. But when I read it the first time, I just I just don't think I had ever seen a script be so crystal clear about the focus, about what it was trying to say, about the way it treated its main character. It was written with such care and thought that I really wanted to put this on screen. And I felt innately that it could be really beautiful to watch this woman live and to look at life through her eyes. And because I hadn't seen an experience like that on screen, especially from that part of the world, it just wasn't even really a question for me, you know? Mm. Yeah, and I was just willing to do whatever was necessary to make it a film, to make it come true.
Yeah. It's a really impressive producing team. You have people like Peter Spears, who worked on Call Me By Your Name. I'm just curious what you learned about that side of the business, about especially with a tough indie like this, getting it off the ground, getting it made. What did that look like for you?
Because we shot on location, so we were in Greece, time was also of the essence. There are different rules in different places. You have a shorter work day, so you have a lot less time to get a lot more things done in a day. So we were having to prioritize, compartmentalize, make sure we were getting shots at the same time. And for me, it was sort of like playing two games at one time, wearing two hats at the same time. So I'm on set, on screen, doing the part and realizing, oh, the sun is going down, so we need to get the scene done so we can actually move on to the next scene because we have three other scenes to shoot today. It's about delegation and time management. And, you know, if things come up that need to be changed, then a whole discussion needs to be had. And we all have to come together as a real team to figure out any kinks that might have come up during the process. It's tough to do both at the same time. That is one thing I learned. But it's also really thrilling to be able to be a part of the conversations that can make a change and the overall journey of the piece, you know?
Yeah. I wondered about wearing two hats, just given the demands of a role like this. I mean, it is not, as you say, something where you can probably just turn it on and off so easily. I imagine it impacted it a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely impacted. And I was lucky because I have an amazing producing partner, Salome, who works with me. And so when we were doing scenes that were really tough to come out of, I just sort of relied on her to be my eyes and ears, because it is hard to sort of come out of those scenes and be the producer, because it just takes a long time for that to shift. So I trusted her implicitly. And when I had my wits about me, I could definitely be a part of that team. But when we were in those very, very intense emotional scenes, I relied on her to make sure that my eyes and ears were still alert and around. So I think it's also about having a really great teammate as well, because you just can't do it on your own. Yeah.
Yeah. There are very few scenes or even shots in this movie that you're not in. It's very centered on your character, on your presence, and the physicality that comes with that. Given the weight of the character, I'm just curious what that experience was like, scene to scene, in terms of the preparation of having to hold that space beginning to end.
It was tough. It was really, really tough. And like, I'm already like this. Yeah, it was just tough. This character has such a feeling of sadness. And I guess even a feeling is not necessarily even the right word. It's like an essence of sadness that sort of just lives in her a lot. And when you're in that space all the time, it can just be hard. It was a really tough place to be. I felt really protective of her, and I really desperately wanted to make sure that I told the utter truth of who she was and what she was going through. There were times it took a lot of time to come out of the spaces. There were times it took a lot of time to fully leave whatever we had done behind. And I sort of prided myself on making sure that I had places to go after a shooting day. And before I came to set in the morning, I would make sure that I was taking care of myself and making sure that I was working out or just releasing some of that energy before going into the next day. Because otherwise I would never have survived. It was just too, it was a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
I can imagine. Yeah. Was it strange to do that and know you had to come out of it that way, like in Greece, where you're not home, you're not even on your continent.
Yeah, there were definitely days where I just felt really lonely.
Yeah.
You know, because it's hard to describe what you're going through to other people because you're the one going through it.
Right.
But there were definitely days when I would come back to the home I was staying in and it'd be really, really, really quiet after shooting all of that. And you'd be left alone with all the thoughts and what you'd been through the day. And you just feel alone. And I was really lucky because a series of wonderful events sort of happened for me to feel like I was flanked by some lovely people. The home I went to happened to be the home of an artist. And they basically lived in a home that was just downstairs. And so if I needed anything, they were right there. And they were the most sweet, most welcoming family. I would never have gone hungry because they always made me food and brought it to the house. And there was this, I didn't know until I got there that they were by design taking care of this dog. Now in Greece, dogs sort of roam the street, but they're all really taken care of by the community. Uh-huh. And this particular dog wandered up to my bedroom door, which was uh-huh. glass and see-through, in the middle of the night. Uh-huh. And she was huge. I didn't know where she was from, and she never left until I left. Wow. So it felt like there was this wonderful spirit. And, you know, they say that dogs sort of understand when a person is going through something. Mm-hmm. It was like she knew I needed company and she just stayed. She stayed right there. I bought her a bed. I bought her some food. I looked after her and she just stayed.
Mm. And that's it was lovely.
Yeah, it was like one of those wonderful things where this sweet spirit just wanted to keep me company and was the gentlest thing ever, but felt like a really protective being. Yeah, I think I just was lucky enough to experience those things whilst going through this big tectonic plate shifting role. Yeah.
I'm also curious about working with Elia Shocket in that context. Yeah. You know, she's an actor with a different energy than I'd seen you play opposite before. The film evolves into a kind of two-hander. She plays an American guide who befriends your character. How was that?
Lovely. She's amazing. She's really amazing. She's really generous in the scene, and she held lots of space for me. I held lots of space for her. There were times when we just like sit quietly together and just like be there together. Mm-hmm. She's a brilliant actor. I was already a fan of hers because I'd seen her other work, and she's just a really beautiful, free spirit that I was really lucky to work with. And I'm glad it was her because she was lovely, just really lovely and generous and sweet and kind. And I mean that from like the bottom of my heart. I honestly don't know if I would have felt the same way if it was someone else. I think she was exactly who it was supposed to be.
Hmm. Yeah, you can feel that on screen, and there's a real tenderness between the two of you that comes across.
Yeah, lots of patience. So sweet mm-hmm. and patient. Like, it was lovely to work with her, really lovely to work with her. Hmm. Yeah.
So this film is very much an independent film, as we said. That is why you're able to talk about it. It is not covered by the strike. It's interesting because just in... you know, looking back at some of your credits and prep for this, you have done almost entirely studio films coming into this movie.
Yeah.
Which obviously we will not be talking about today.
No.
but I wonder, just in terms of the experience of the visibility of the film, of getting the word out, like, it must feel a little bit different, especially being a producer on it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely different. This one, I always call it the little engine that could, like... Mm. And there is a wonderful thing in this, I think, that it has to be up to us to really get the word out, that it's really up to us to do the work that we can in order for people to see this movie, because I really do want people to see it. And mm-hmm. for those who have seen it, I've had the most lovely reaction, and people come back and they say, it seems to have stuck with me, it stays with me, and it won't leave. And that's what I want people to know, that this is one of those movies that will stay with you, and it's an important piece of work because it teaches you about things that we just don't know about, and it's also like the human condition. And I think the wonderful thing about it being an independent is that it's sort of in our control how we share it and how we get it out there, and hopefully those who see it really do want to see it, and I think that's the special thing about it.
Yeah. Given the issues that have come up during the strike, it also feels like the kind of film that is worth, very much worth supporting right now.
Yeah. 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 And thank you for saying that. I hope so. I want people to feel that. It's just, I love this movie with all my heart, and I put my heart and soul and sweat and tears and blood and all of that stuff into it. So yeah, I want to share it with everyone who can see it.
Yeah. Do you come off of a project like this feeling not necessarily different, but or energized, looking in a new direction of the kinds of films you want to make, both as an actor and now a producer?
Yeah, I came off the film exhausted, but really proud of the thing that we had managed to do. We got to the end of it and I couldn't believe it. I was just like, we'd had such a journey to get to that point. And I guess it made me even more determined to want to make important stories, to tell the stories of those who would not normally be told, and to hear more about the people that I don't know enough about. You know, it changed sort of not just what I want to make, but what I want to see. Mm. And I think that really is sort of the seed that will grow into what kinds of films I want to make. Because yes, studio movies are amazing and can be wonderful, but these little gems, these indie movies that you don't know about until someone says, hey, you should see this movie, or, you know, you're walking past something and there's one advert somewhere, there's one poster somewhere that you happen to be passing, you're curious about it. Some of those are often the most meaningful, most arresting movies that there are. So I hope I can keep doing that.
Yeah. So SAG-AFTRA has been on strike for going on 3 months now.
Yes.
You have a very big project that we won't talk about, but that is in some stage of development, let's say.
Yes.
But how have you experienced the strike? How was your, you know, schedule plans? How were they impacted? And what are you hoping is on the other side of this?
I took a break for a second. I stopped and I rested. But because I am a complete creative, that just never stops, really. So I've been singing left, right, and center all over the place. So I've been back and forth to New York, or, you know, and I'm going to be going to DC at some point, I think, just singing. We were at the Blue Note last night. I sang with a friend of mine. And,
oh, that's great.
You know, that's sort of what I've been doing. And taking care of myself and seeing friends that I don't get to see and meeting people when I don't have the time usually to meet. And, you know, that's what I've been trying to do. Still expanding my creativity, but also leaning into people and family and friends that I love. Yeah, kind of what I've done. And I hope on the other side of this, I hope we're all empowered to... The phrase that comes to mind is take care of one another. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are all really working very hard. And I think that sometimes that gets taken for granted and we don't quite realize that a lot of work is being done, not just on screen, but behind the screen as well. We're all working really hard and we all deserve to be treated fairly for the work that we're doing.
Hmm. Seems like a good sentiment.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of singing, you also have a beautiful song that's a part of this film.
Yeah.
You've already been Oscar nominated for both acting and songwriting for the same movie. You have another great kind of doubleheader here. But what does that relationship look like between you for a film like this where you are acting in it, you do have a song in it, you're also producing it. But how do those creative sides meld, I suppose?
When we started this, I didn't intend to write the song or co-write the song at the end of this movie. It's just that whilst I was doing it, I would run every morning and I would listen to music, and this particular artist, Laura Mvula, a song started playing, a song called Father, and my brain and my heart automatically knew that this is the person that if we were to make a song, would make the song for this particular movie. It just felt right. And I ran to the rest of my producers. I was like, this is the person that if I'm going to do a song, I want to write it with this person. I think she knows what is best. I think she would be able to make this song the way I hear the song in my head. And you never know until you meet and you get into a room with someone whether or not it will work. And when I went to sit and talk with Laura, I sent her the movie. I asked her to just take a look at it. And she sent me back the sort of like the very first verse and the sound of what could have been the chorus. And I fell in love. And so we automatically got into a room and started writing, and it sort of rose itself. It didn't take very long for us to write, and we worked together to make it be what it is. And it's just like passion is where it comes from for me. I knew I wanted to put everything I could put into this movie, however possible. So if that meant I was going to co-write a song, then I was going to co-write a song. If that meant that I was going to be on set for as many hours as I needed to in order to help produce, then that was what I was going to do. And to be in it, I was going to pour everything I could pour into it as an actor. And for me, that just makes for a holistic experience when it comes to being a part of a movie, any movie, but particularly this one.
You mentioned taking a little break as the strike began. And I thought of just the kind of whirlwind 5 or 6 years you've had since, especially doing Color Purple on Broadway. Was there a moment for you of just taking stock of what these last few years have been like? I mean, especially now you have this movie coming out, Color Purple. You're not in it, but of course it feels a little full circle to me. I don't know if it feels that way to you.
Yeah. I definitely had a moment of that. I think I was on my treadmill and I just was like, whoa. Lots has happened. A lot has happened. Cause you just, you know, it's true. You don't get the time to like stop until you do. And then just, you know, looking at what had happened, the things that were happening, where I was, it all just sort of like came into focus. And I just feel really, really grateful. I feel really grateful for where I am, what I've been able to do, how far I've come, because it's crazy. I don't know that I expected all of this to happen, but it's fun and cool.
That does it for today's show. We'll be back next week. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com, on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider. I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, and Rebecca
M. Ford.
And David.
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.